This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
From Headstuff Studios in Dublin, welcome to Motherfucklore, a podcast about words, Irish, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I'm Dara O'Shea. I've been reading a book recently, Osgailga, called Nonín, and it is one of the most exciting and interesting books Osgailga I've read in a while. I'm just blown away by it. It is a book in, I suppose you say it's in verse, and it's a story of a teenage girl who meets a chap online. And the cover art design has been done by Kirsten Scheele, who does the artwork for this very podcast. And I am absolutely delighted to have the author on the phone with me today. Mara Zeff, Fáilte go Folklore.
Girl, like it. It's lovely to be with you.
We are just delighted to have you. Mara, can you, first of all, maybe just tell our listeners who might not be familiar with your work a little bit about yourself?
So I now have 8 books that I've written, all of which are in Irish. So I started out writing, first of all, historical fiction. So my first book was called, or it's called Tubbuster and Titanic, which follows the story of a brother and sister who discover like a magic door in their granny's house, and they go through it and they are transported in time. So there was the Titanic, and then there was a follow-up of that with the Vikings in Dublin. So that's where I started out, because my own background is in history. Then I got into picture books. So I wrote Nago or Skull, Don't Go to School, which is about a little bear starting school, and he's really excited, but his mommy doesn't want him to go. It's kind of a role reversal story. And it was a big game changer for me, actually, because it then got translated to like 7 languages around the world. It's for sale in America and China and Korea and all sorts. So that was really exciting for me. It's now available in English in Ireland and the UK as well. And then I've been writing a series of picture books about a girl called Rita. Okay. And they're with illustrator Andrew Whitson. And Snahich were the publishers of those. And that's been a real interesting journey, just in that writing a series is such a different thing, and having this character who lives beyond individual stories and books. So that's been brilliant. And we've got more of hers to come. Then the latest one is really something a bit different for me, because Nonín is for teenagers for the first time, or young adults, really. It's kind of even the older side of teens, so into young adults. And that's been a real departure for me, and a really big learning curve as well, I guess. But beyond that, I've been the Children's Writing Fellow for Northern Ireland, the first person to do that job. I've just finished it recently, and that was based at the Seamus Heaney Centre in Belfast there. At Queen's, and it was just a wonderful thing to do, because on the other, you've got all the writing side, which can be so solitary and so sort of lonely in a sense, just you and your book. But this was the other side of going out into schools and festivals and libraries and getting children writing, and was involved in all sorts of projects as part of that. So it was really lovely antidote, actually, to the writing side of things.
Absolutely. And as you say there, Nonine is a very different kind of book to the book about the teddy bear wanting to go to school. And it is a it's a book that really kind of grips you very early on, in that you'd call it a verse. It's written in verse, but it's a novel, but it's in verse. And in some ways, the individual chapters, which are only a page or two each, they are almost like emails or long text messages, but they are poems.
Yeah, it was really interesting to write in that way, actually, because I find that very often when I try and write in prose, my prose wants to sort of fragment itself and break up. Anyway, because what I found was when you write like that, it's like you've got the shape of the page, the shape of the words, as much as you've got the sound of the words or the meaning of the words. So you've kind of got an extra, you know, if you normally write in 2D, you're in 3D, in the verse novel, you've got this extra kind of element to it where you can, you know, lots of repetition and space, and you can use the space in interesting ways as well. So I really loved writing like that. I just find it easy for the words to flow, or for the emotions to flow or something. There was some way that I find it a lot easier than prose. And that surprised me, because I thought it was going to be a very difficult thing to write.
But it just works so well. And even when you are reading it and you think that if somebody finds it odd, initially odd looking on a page, when you're reading it, you realize it couldn't be going down any other way. And I suppose, particularly those kind of poetic techniques, I'm always getting people asking me that they're a learner, or that they're an adult who maybe doesn't want to necessarily read a kid's book, but they want something that's kind of maybe straightforward Irish or something that's not challenging. But I wouldn't say maybe not challenging it maybe isn't the right word, but I think the fact that the pace that's created by the short chapters and the repetition of certain words kind of poetically for its intensity of meaning does actually make it very handy for a reader returning to Irish to actually kind of follow what's going on very quickly without having the English next to it.
I think that's definitely true. And it's a strange thing, because when people hear that something's written in verse, their first instinct is to imagine that that makes it complex or hard to get into. And I think once anybody's ever read anything in free verse, you realize that it's really the opposite. It's like you've taken, it's like a condensed version of a novel. You've taken out all the fat or all of the extras, and you've pared it down. So it's very fast moving, and it's very easy to read as a genre. So they find that I think in all languages that it's been a bit of a game changer, specifically for reluctant readers or people who feel challenged when they see a big, you know, there's lots of people that their hearts sink when they see the length of a book. Just that there's a commitment of time, or, you know, we're all busy people, and sometimes it's that. But sometimes as well, especially with teens and stuff, there's just a sense in which they don't want to take on a long book like that. So when I was reading these books in English, I thought, just as you said, that there was an extra element in which this would be great for Irish, because as you mentioned, adult learners, but also for Irish speaking teenagers, there's an interesting thing that happens as you go through, as people go through their education, that there's sometimes a point at which, because there's so much choice in English for reading and whatever, that the English reading takes off, and that there's a reluctance to read in Irish through lack of material, but also there's some other obstacle there maybe for people. So I just thought this would cut through it, you know, that this, well, hopefully can be sort of a new stepping stone or something in the mix, that people can lift it. And as you say, there's an ease of reading it that is maybe different from a lot of books.
Absolutely. And it is a very, I'd say it's an, as well as the actual, the text itself, it is an urgently topical book.
It's really quite dark, isn't it?
It's
worth
is.
Saying at this point that it takes like a health warning or something. You know, I always worry about the people who are used to reading my books that are about, you know, robots and fairy godmothers and dragons. And that if anyone should lift this book, they're expecting that they're going to be in for a bit of a shock, I think, because it is dark. And as you say, topical, I think that this is just a huge issue of our time, of the internet being so important. It is an absolute lifeline to us. But there being that other side to it as well, that really, really dark potential in there of us needing to know, needing to be alert and aware to where to trust, where not to trust, where to be open, where not to, and just where those lines are, I guess.
Very much so. It's something I think about all the time, and we think about the vulnerability and what the world, but that of I suppose the dangers of the online world, and but there's also I suppose the something that comes across the books is, you know, the offline world isn't great either sometimes.
I don't think it's that different in a lot of ways, but I think that people are more aware or alert to where the lines of public and private are in the real world, you know, and it's when it's virtual, people can feel so close so quickly to people where they really have no knowledge of who they are or who they're connected to or what their background is and that kind of thing. And I think that I just sense, I live with a lot of teenagers at home. I've got five kids at home between children and stepchildren, and three of them are teenagers. And so I hear the kind of the mistrust they have of safety information they're given. And I understand it. It's that kind of when you're that age and your teachers are telling you, you know, don't drink alcohol or you'll die. And it's that kind of, you know, over-exaggerated messages that they just learn to brush off. And I think that when they're talked to about the internet, they feel like, and kind of rightly so, it's their world, not the world of the generation before who are trying to teach them about it. But there's a real sense of invincibility that frightens me, because I think if you know how vulnerable you are, then you're in a safe place. And if you feel invincible, then you're really not.
Yes.
And I guess that's the message I was trying to get across in the book, rather than any kind of talking down. You know, just that kind of sense that you've got your eyes wide open and you'll be good.
It's a funny one, because I'm 41 years old now, and a phenomenon among internet users of my generation, and this comes up every August, so probably not long after this episode comes out, there'll be people tweeting about how about leaving cert results, and they were saying, you know, don't worry if your A level results or your leaving cert results aren't great, mine weren't great, now I'm a big success, and then the response is, You're 41. No young people follow you. They're not even on the same platform as you. They're not even using different things. And there's been some versions of social media around for so long that they're actually, you do have full digital natives now, who people, teenagers who've grown up in a world when there never really has, when there hasn't been an alternative to a social media online. And I remember someone recently was saying that was talking about couples meeting online through Tinder or Grindr or those sorts of things. And they're saying that when a person meets someone they're interested in, that there's always this element of Facebook stalking or something almost now. And it's like, say, ultimately all dating is somewhat online now. And even then, a person having absolutely no social media profile at all is often seen as almost like a danger sign almost.
It's amazing the transformations that the internet has brought that I don't think we'll understand until we can look back from future generations. But as you said earlier on, and I think it's just really, really important that there's these revolutions, but there's also the sense in which the universal truths are still true, and that people's interactions with each other are still what they've always been. They're just in a different place, you know?
Yes.
But one of the other things that I was really interested to explore in the book was just the questions of this kind of guilt that people take on around when something bad happens, this instinct to find out who's to blame.
Yeah.
And to apportion blame, and that there's a huge sense in which for generations, I suppose the generation above me, but that there's a huge sense in which there's a fear of the internet, and that feeds into this sense of, you know, people being irresponsible and that it's their own fault to get themselves in these situations. And it was really important to me in the book as well, whilst saying let's all be aware and keep our eyes open, but also saying, like, let's make sure we always put the blame in the right place, that it's perpetrators of horrific acts who are to blame and not people who are the victims. And that goes so deeply in our society, I think, this victim blaming.
Yes.
that it was something that was really interesting to unpick, just in terms of Noeen's mother in the story and how it's all bound up with her fears. Mm-hmm. And how her fearful place that she ties herself into then gets reflected onto, why has this happened to my daughter? Is it her fault? Is it my fault? And all of these, you know, this whirlwind of blame that we have in our culture. And I just, you know, just aside from the internet things, there's all sorts of questions in there that are true regardless of where something happens or how it happens.
Mammy na Clochish. The Stone Age, those references that were very good. It is something that, and we do see more and more of these stories. We hear them anecdotally, or we hear them on the news. And it's, as you say, the establishing blame, and it can often distract from actually kind of preventing things happening again, or from learning from things. Because so often, people think that if something isn't establishing, proving that something isn't their fault is more important than proving what happened. Mm. So, and where did you say that the inspiration for the book came from? Between the format you used and the actual subject matter, was there any one moment you thought, this is like, I have to write this book?
I think that people have asked me this before in relation to why the change as well, you know, why to suddenly write something that's really quite different. I think that what's happening to me as a writer is that an awful lot of what's preoccupying me in my day-to-day life comes out in my writing. I guess that's something that's very normal. I'm not saying that, you know, robots and teddy bears are, yeah. But actually I wrote this story about starting school. My youngest was starting school, and there has been a sense in which my home life and my parenting life has been where, you know, where you're obsessing about and the issues that you're dealing with. So I guess there's a kind of a natural sense in which, as the years have gone by, and my own children are older, where these are the issues that you're surrounded by on a daily basis, and that you're grappling with and struggling with, maybe, and reading about and thinking about. So I guess that's you know, some of where it came from, just a feeling that there was an important, that it's an important moment in time, I guess, and that this question of trust and relationships and love, that it was something that was just that I was ready to write. Yeah. But the genre was really different, because you've got this really, really dark subject matter. I mean, really dark. And when I didn't really think it through when I thought to start on the book, how dark my research would have to get. I hadn't kind of, it seems obvious in hindsight, but I hadn't really thought through that I was going to spend weeks and months of my life researching, you know, paedophile psychology. And it's just, you know, all sorts of really, really dark, nasty. I'm really glad nobody was looking at my Google search history at the time, because some of it was really, really difficult. So on the one hand, you've got this really difficult subject. And then on the other hand, the genre, which actually was something so light and so different for me, that I felt I was able to stretch myself a bit as a writer. Much as I love writing picture books, and I'm still writing picture books, it's still a very deep love of mine. But it's, you know, you're very restricted in terms of the numbers of words that you can use, the types of words that you can use. So this felt a bit liberating language-wise, you know, that I could just play a little, I guess, with language. And so I knew that I wanted to write a verse novel, because I'd been enjoying reading verse novels, and I thought, Irish needs a verse novel for young adults. And so there was kind of a sense as well. I think always when you're writing in a minority language, you can't do it without an awareness of where you feel gaps are in that market, or where you think, what you think might be useful or needed or lacking. I think that's different from when you're writing in English, that you just have a sense the whole time of being able to add to a canon. And I did have a strong sense that Irish is brilliant now for kids' books, and it goes a bit into teenage, but it's very safe in young teenage, I think, and that there wasn't anything sort of on this level, which is just a wee bit more, I guess, is a little bit shocking as a book. It's a bit more, it goes into a different age range. Which is something that is kind of challenging, I think, as well. I think Irish language literature world has been quite safe.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel a strange sense when you're pushing at the boundaries of it. That certainly the publisher had some interesting feedback from teachers who were like, ooh, that's a bit, what was the word they used? That's a bit, not gory. What was the word? I can't remember the word they used, but it was graphic. It's a bit graphic. I was like, yeah, it is a bit graphic. It doesn't pull any punches.
But I think that's great because, I mean, so often a lot of people who are doing things in Irish, I know your near neighbours, the rappers Kneecap, they hear this a bit, that sometimes things that are done in Irish are almost expected to be for everyone and are expected to be kind of, you know, specifically educational. And sometimes you say, no, actually, just this is the language I write in, this is the language I compose in, this is the language I perform in. And I want it to be as personal as possible. And sometimes you think that, yes, this isn't for everyone. It won't necessarily be for every single person who wants to just read as many Irish books as possible. But this is, but nothing great is ever for everyone.
And you have to ask the question, you know, would it be a problem if it existed in English? No.
Yes.
When you think of exactly. The things that kids, and like, I know what kids love reading at this age. You know, I kind of put 15 plus in my head on this book, and I've got 15 and 16 year olds at home, and I know the kind of stuff they're reading. I know what they're watching. And it's graphic, and they have no, I think they have no problem with dark compared to their parents like me, that we find it a lot more difficult. So I've been having lots of feedback from really traumatized parents who've been reading this, parents of teenagers. I'm like, sorry guys, it's, you know, you can enjoy it, but it wasn't actually written for you. But I think there's a distinction there between what teenagers and what young adults will want to read and what schools will want to teach. And I'd like to think that No Nguyen could be both. I think there's a strong case that you could make there, but it's a question that, you know, we shouldn't have to let teachers, who can be quite a conservative bunch, certainly when they've got their teaching hats on, that we shouldn't necessarily let them be gatekeepers for what literature gets written in Irish. And I think that's really, really important. It's really important that we have books that kids will want to pick up and read themselves, or 20 somethings or whatever, because I think that young adult label is a very wide one. I don't think the line is easily drawn about where that should fall. I don't think that if we only think of, and I think for the publishers it's quite difficult because in terms of sales, once a book gets taken up by schools as a school text, then obviously their sales are very, very different in Irish. So there's a kind of an incentive there for them to always be conservative as well. So I was really, really grateful to Cushliffe to kind of go with it. And they really did. They really stood behind it the whole way through, and were quite unapologetic about writing something that was just a bit edgier than we're used to in Irish. That was lovely.
Yeah, I think it was definitely a risk worth taking. It's been wonderful. Mara, I was just thinking there that, I mean, you would have done Irish for A-levels, I'm guessing, yes?
Yeah, I was brought up speaking Irish at home. Ah. But I did it for A-level as well at school, yeah.
So, and I'm just thinking, we get these conversations a lot on this podcast, and all of the contributors hear this afterwards, the way it's taught, Irish isn't very good. But the... What books would you have read when you're doing Irish for the A-levels compared to what's done on the Leaving Cert?
You see, that thing about how it's taught is only something I've ever heard from Southerners.
Yeah.
I've never in my life heard anybody in the North talk about the way that Irish is taught. Well, partly it's not a compulsory language, so a compulsory subject. So there may be an awful lot of it that falls just simply because of that. Mm. So it's very much something that's chosen. And so it's people who have a real love of it who tend to study it. So that maybe changes the whole culture of it as well.
Yeah.
But we were taught just incredibly. I couldn't speak highly enough of my Irish teachers at school. Mm. And that whole experience of going to the Gaeltacht and just being submerged in some sort of other world is what it felt like. But I guess I'd grown up that way. We felt like, you know, being brought up with Irish myths and legends and old songs and all of that kind of stuff, that it felt quite alien to me then when I went to school. My schooling was through English. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like there was these two worlds and they didn't meet. And so there was a lovely sense for me then later on when I did do A-level Irish and things, of just kind of my worlds coming together, where the wider world knew about some of this stuff as well. It wasn't just a home secret, you know. Mm. And then funny enough, I went to study in Oxford. I did history over there, and they were so open to the Irish side of my life that also really took me aback. So They were happy for me to go and study Gaelic poems and to spend as long as I wanted learning, you know, all sorts of stuff about history and literature and whatever of the Irish language. And it was just really interesting because you have all these lines that are drawn for you by politics and schooling and whatever, and it was just really liberating for me then to find people just so open to it and I'm fascinated by it, because why wouldn't you be?
It's a great Irish scene in Oxford. We have been told, and there's a hurling club and a GAA club, and there's lots of Irish lectures and stuff there as well. It's a little scene.
Absolutely.
But so Amara, tell us what do you have next on the horizon? Obviously, this book has been a success, and what do you have coming in the next few months in 2019 before the end of this decade?
I have a really beautiful new book coming out, hopefully in September, with Fata Fata. And it's called An Félachán Agus An Rí, The Butterfly and the King. Oh. And it's a retelling of the old myth of Mir and Éirinn. So I was tasked with bringing it up to date. You know, we've kind of had an awful lot of this with Grimm's fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales and whatever, where we look at them now and sort of say, how does this fit with where we are as a society and our values and whatever, specifically in terms of gender. So yes, this is a kind of a looking back on this old story, a beautiful, beautiful old story. We have it from the Book of the Dun Cow in the 12th century. But it's much older than that, about this girl who's transformed into a butterfly. It's a sort of a love story, or maybe a love triangle, if you want to think of it that way. But a really, really fantastic story. But the main character, it's very definitely Éirinn's story, but the main character in the story as we have it has no agency whatsoever in her own story. So she's bewitched and she's sold and she's finally won in a game of chess. I mean, it's that stark.
Oh, wow.
So I was given this story to look at it again and to retell it for modern children in a way that we would be happy to tell it now. And I thought that was fascinating. I spent quite a lot of time going back into very, very strange old versions of this story. And I grew up with the story myself. So it's quite hard when you're given something that's really very precious to you and you're afraid to mess with it too much, you know, to make sure that the elements of that, it's still the same story, but that it's just a reworking of it. So that's, I've finished that, and it's being illustrated by a really fantastic illustrator called Shona Shirley MacDonald. I don't know if you've come across her work, but she's absolutely, it's going to be very, very, very beautiful book, I think, just judging by what I've seen of her pictures as well. So I have that coming out hopefully in September, and I have a new Rita book as well. So Rita, in each book, she's like this little girl with these big mad ideas. So she'll face like a really normal problem and then she'll come up with a completely fantastical solution. So she's had a robot and a fairy godmother and a witch and a dragon. And in this story, it's Rita Agus and Ninja. So she's going there's going to be a lot of ninjas in this book. And I can't wait. Do you know when you've got a book coming out that you know that it's not just the book itself, but I'm going to have so much fun in schools with this. So I'm going to make some kind of, I don't know, ninja masterclass. And I can't wait. So we've got that to look forward to as well. Various things on the horizon, but lots of schools projects on the horizon as well. I'm kind of I'm in a funny place now where I'm just kind of trying to, I've got so many different areas that I've been writing in that I really trying to, it's quite difficult to work out where I want to go next. So I'd love to write another verse novel. I'd love to do another Nonien.
Oh, yes.
Or a completely different Nonien. But I'm also just, I can't stay away from the picture books. So I'm not sure. It seems like a really unlikely combination, but I think that's where my attention's going to be.
Certainly sounds like you get your hands full and you did it right. And before we wrap up, I do like to ask our guests what their favourite Irish word is.
I love the word shisternach. I love onomatopoeic words anyway, but there's something about shisternach that just, whether it's describing wind in the trees or the rustle of silk or whatever, it's just a really, really beautiful word. So shisternach, that would be my word.
Fantastic. Maura, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Dara.
So until the next time, it's a slán from me.
Okay, slánnish.
Catch you next time. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Hope you're all well. So I picked two schlochtene from, like, sections from the story that I thought were kind of indicative of the story without spoiling it, and we're also maybe interesting enough that might make you want to read more. So I suppose, like, that would be my ideal if I had written this book, and what I would want people to do, you know, not give away the story but also make people intrigued. So they are 34 and 35, so Pogue and Borja, and they're on pages 70 to 73, short and sweet but enough that might make people interested. I'm going to try and do my best poetry voice now. So here we go.
Tréacha cathair, Pog. Fóg tú bóchul rive sa osin lom. Nair a chorin sisin an cheist, níl sé magafum, dum a chána, nó a corbrú. Ní ekin sé faib, nór in siam dó, nár fóg, go fól. O da tjochig lomsa, pog a hort dutch an nonin a derse. Du chéad fóg, veik solis na réalta stigaun. Eg drith lú, the viola, agus tas na greene, the kraken, lá saura, veik kinata saun, agus plurin biog blasta, den voodoo durcha, len a spies ru. Tréacha cuaig, Borja. Anónín, mar charalat, a scríbhan éimer, go firmálta. A wall is nach caralum níos mói. Cathe mé rá, gwil me Borja fút. Iver hén, níl aithna agat sin na hílan sise. Iver a dó, cathan tú gach bumata den lá, an own lash, tá darma dainte agat an earsail. Cadé mar a hig a callín nach raibhing rá, go bio bahach fear is atá seo. Iver a trí, níor castú fiú, go fóir.
If you want me to do more, let us know, Derek, and I can. But like I said, I don't want to give away the story. I'd like people to actually buy this book because it's actually deadly, as you know. But let me know, and I can do that. I hope to see you all soon. Hope you're well. hope you're missing me loads and you haven't replaced me yet. Okay, bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
I just want to let you know, Brian, that I am sitting under a duvet with a flashlamp.